Next case on the docket is Saladin versus Commonwealth. Mr. Husby and Mr. Katz. Good morning, Mr. Husby. Is that how you pronounce it?
It is.
You have 15 minutes. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
About 5 minutes, please.
Okay. You may proceed when you're ready.
May it please the court, my name is Mason Husby and I represent the appellant, Mr. Abdul Salahuddin. Procedurally, what Mr. Salahuddin was found guilty of was one count of possession of cocaine, one possession with intent to distribute heroin, and felony obstruction of justice. On appeal, we've raised three assignments of error. The first and second assignments of error both directly relate to the denial of by the trial court of the suppression motion, and then the third is an evidentiary matter regarding the expert's opinion as to weight. Talking first about the suppression motion, essentially what happened in this case is there's multiple searches conducted without a warrant. The warrant is finally later obtained, and there's also a return to the room prior to the warrant that the court found exigent circumstances there. But what the trial court ruled was that although Mr. Salahuddin had standing, as the Commonwealth conceded at the suppression motion, his expectation of privacy was not reasonable.
Counsel, did the Commonwealth concede that he was an overnight guest?
They conceded that he was an overnight guest and had standing to challenge the seizure of the items in the search of the room.
And your position is that as an overnight guest, he had as much rights as the person who rented, but not more.
Correct. Okay. And with that, essentially what they did was they went into the room to get probable cause to get a warrant to search the room. That's essentially what happened in this case. When you go through each search, and we can start with the first search. When the officers arrived, they've been summoned there by the hotel manager because she states that she saw marijuana in the room. They arrive, they go up with her into the room. With that, they don't have a warrant to get there, so we have to look at what the other exceptions to the warrant requirement would be. At the initial entry, there's no exigent circumstances. It's an unoccupied room. That's what the officers know at that point. All they have is...
But, counsel, there's also the agreement that was signed when the room was rented, which acknowledged that the management reserved the right to search the, or to walk into the room to inspect the room. So how is Mr. Salahuddin in a higher position than the person who agreed to that term?
I don't think that the contract is necessarily dispositive in this case. When we look at the Supreme Court precedent and the precedent out of this court, the only argument that they had to enter the room is apparent authority. How do we judge apparent authority?
But wait a minute, though. He can't exceed the rights of the renter.
Correct.
You agreed to that.
I agreed.
And that is correct under the law. So isn't he bound by the same terms that the renter is bound by?
I mean, there's a question of notice when it comes to a reasonable expectation of privacy regarding that. He had no notice of that contract.
Well, he doesn't need to have notice of the contract.
I apologize.
Under the objective state, I mean, you know, you've got the subjective and the objective that you consider, and he's not.
Correct.
if he's going to use a room that is not his, that he has not rented, he doesn't get to exceed the authority of the person renting it, does he?
In this case, I think it's a different analysis, and Stoner cautions courts to look at property law as any basis for evaluating a reasonable expectation of privacy. What is important is what the officers knew. Those are the people that were judging whether or not they were reasonable in their actions. So when they get to the room, they have there's no evidence in the record that was presented at the suppression hearing that they had any knowledge of that contract prior to entering the room. So all you have is the officers coming to the hotel thinking that, well, the hotel manager said there's marijuana, she's got a key to the room, that's enough for me to go to forego the warrant requirement.
He gets to claim no knowledge of the contract and try to escape that, then why on earth does he then get to be called an overnight guest.
Well, and with the overnight guest, that's already has been conceded by the Commonwealth. The standing has already been conceded at the suppression motion by the Commonwealth. I don't believe that they can raise a standing issue here on appeal.
And if you concede, if that's conceded that he's an overnight guest, then why do you then get to try to have your cake and eat it too? He's an overnight guest, but he's then not bound by the rules of an overnight guest.
Well, even if he's not bound by the contract, and I think the contract itself is almost a red herring in this, that was presented in this case. The contract, because what is important is what the officers knew prior to entering the room. Prior to entering the room, they had no knowledge of the contract. We could say that if Ms. Fowler, the hotel manager, had said, I have this contract, it lets me inspect everything, that would be apparent authority to enter it. Again, I would still argue that contract is not a waiver of your Fourth Amendment right. That contract is...
Well, let's go back to the actual language of the contract, which says that, you know, guests must comply with all the laws, and failing to do so may result in the renter being asked to leave the premises. Why does that not kick in when the motel manager sees drugs in the room, obviously a violation of the law, and calls the police?
Well, we don't know if she saw drugs in the room. If we look at the record, what she says that she did, and this was not investigated by the officers at all when they first arrived, it was only later brought out on cross-examination, is that she went into the room, saw what she thought was marijuana, she did not pick it up, did not say it, that she smelt it, didn't do anything to that.
Isn't the reasonable inference that she saw what she believed to be marijuana and called the police?
Well, if she called the police,
and
you'll look at the record about her in her testimony, she admits that, well, I'm not an expert, I don't know any. It's actually the Commonwealth that specifically
understood. It's not proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was marijuana, but it certainly provides a basis to believe that the defendant was violating the law in that room.
But we have to look at the government's actions, not Ms. Fowler's actions. But the government's actions in this case is that when they come to the room, they do no independent investigation. They take her word for it, and they enter the room without any sort of investigation. They don't, other than her name tag and her identity as...
Could they have gotten a search warrant based on her statement that she believed there was marijuana in the room?
I don't believe that they could have gotten a search warrant just based off of her statement. If they would have done some investigation... For example, if they would have said, how do you know it's marijuana? Where did you see it? How much of it? What did it look like? They didn't do any of those steps to try to say that she knew what she saw was marijuana. And in fact, in the record, the Commonwealth states on redirect, again on this, you're not an expert, and I understand the court's position in terms of reasonable doubt, but she says, well, and that's why you called the police, so they could verify it. Yes, because I didn't know. And that's after she's agreed with the statement that she doesn't know the smell, what it looks like, or anything like that. I would point to the page, but it's on the last page of the redirect.
Counsel, are you familiar with the McCarry case out of this court?
Refresh my memory.
All right. McCarry involved a situation where the court essentially found that if somebody was blatantly violating the law and rented a hotel room.
This is where, and if I'm correct, this is where the person was actively destroying the room.
Correct.
And the court specifically talked about the immediacy of it. In fact, it kind of got close to the line of an emergency exception, that this is active destruction of the room, and that they needed to intervene at that very moment so that it wouldn't happen. In this case, they had no reason to go into the room prior to getting a warrant. They could have stood outside the room.
Which they essentially did.
Mm-hmm.
The first viewing in the room, they tried that, and they weren't particularly successful, were they?
Well, they didn't really stand next to the room. They didn't really stand next to the room, Your Honor. What they did was, one of the benefits of the body cam is, and it's in the record, is that you can... that you have two entries, one by Officer Brooks, Officer Young, and Ms. Fowler, and then you have a second entry by Detective Clark from the Narcotics Department. Again, both of those entries without a warrant or any type of apparent authority that we contend is reasonable. And then from there, you have the hotel manager saying that she'll disable the key lock and that they can wait at the front desk. So they're not even on the same floor stationed outside of the room when the tenants return.
Well, counsel, you keep indicating that there's not actual authority. Let's say that we agree with you. In the totality of the circumstances, would it be reasonable for the police officers to believe that there was actually a parent for you? We've got a manager who obviously is in a position where she would have access to the rooms that alerts them to a potential issue and then allows them to walk into the room. So why wouldn't that be enough?
Matlock and Stoner tell us that it's not enough. Matlock specifically says, and forgive me, I don't have the direct quote, but essentially says you can't, when it comes to a third party, you can't accept mere statements of authority just because of a property interest. If we took this in another context and said, if a landlord came into my apartment and saw something and then went to the police, that doesn't mean that the police can then go in without a warrant or some sort of exception to the warrant. It's a living space. The Stoner says it's a living space, and because of that,
Doesn't it also say that it's sort of accepted that by the person renting the room that people are going to come into the room, that it's inherent in the agreement. There are going to be people coming in who are either janitors or maids or fixing whatever needs to be fixed. So why wouldn't that be the same in this particular room?
Well, the janitors and all those folks can come into the room, and if...
What if they find a dead body in the room?
I don't believe there's any dead body exception.
I'm just making it a more obvious crime.
I don't think that's analogous to this case. In terms of a dead body, or if we take it even a step further, they find someone tied up in
your position
in the
is
room.
It would be closer to McCary at that.
It would be closer to McCary at that point. But at this juncture, they had no reason to get into that room, and we have continued violations all along the way. Now,
counsel, you're into your rebuttal. I just want you to be aware.
Thank you for telling me.
Thank you, counsel.
Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Katz.
Hey, please, the court, I'm Benjamin Katz, appearing on behalf of the Commonwealth. And these circumstances are certainly a dense and richly textured exercise of Fourth Amendment jurisprudence, not unlike a bar examination
exercise.
Glad
you're seeing it that way. Thank you.
I'll endeavor to be brief so I don't treat the court to a treatise of the entire brief filed by the Commonwealth, but I think the starting point for any analysis needs to be the entry by Fowler and also the agreement that concerns the use of the hotel room. And respectfully, counsel argues that that's a red herring. I would submit it's not. I think starting with a flawed premise, that drives counsel's entire argument, but I think approaching it in the appropriate light reveals that there isn't a Fourth Amendment implication. And if I could direct the court to 133 of the joint appendix, this is the trial court's findings and conclusions of law in the motion to suppress, particularly lines 4 through 14. And I would submit the reasonable inference that flows from these findings, viewed in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, as the court must do at this juncture, is that there was no reasonable expectation of privacy. And that conclusion is driven by facts that are entitled to deference, that this gentleman, as the court has pointed out in its questions, could enjoy no expectation of privacy greater than the actual renter of the room. And clearly, in light of the agreement that expressly gave the hotel permission to enter and check on the property and make sure it was in good condition and not posing a risk to any guests, any belief or any expectation of privacy was unreasonable under those circumstances. But as Your Honor pointed out, there is also the apparent authority of Fowler. So even if that is not dispositive of the issue, in light of McLaughlin and Caldwell from this court, clearly the officers could rely on Fowler's apparent authority. So I would submit that there's not a Fourth Amendment implication in the initial entry by Fowler to the extent that the officers went in with her. They were entitled to rely on her authority. This is distinguishable, factually, materially distinguishable from Stoner. This is not the police calling up and engineering a search, saying, hey, can you go in that room? This is the normal exercise of Fowler's authority as the property manager. And I would submit, as pointed out in brief, this is different from Hargraves as well. This is not the officers gaining entry and conducting a full search. This is the property manager conducting a search, not at the instigation of the officers. They're standing there silent while she continues to check the contents of the room in light of the drugs that are plainly visible, the marijuana that's plainly visible.
There's no evidence that she simply called the police to protect her safety interest when she did the second search, is there?
There isn't, but I would submit that given the testimony of the purpose for why they maintained this right to go in and check the rooms, that's a logical inference that flows from the evidence. There's no evidence that suggests to the contrary. And I think to conclude that would be to view the evidence not in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth. There is clear testimony on the record why the hotel does this, the purpose for doing it, and I think the inference that flows from it is on this occasion, Fowler was animated by the same purpose. If we consider the factors set forth in Jarrett, I think it is clear that Fowler was not acting as a government agent when she made the initial entry. And so addressing those topics, I think if we can ascertain that the Fourth Amendment is not implicated and that the information that supported the search warrant was not unlawfully obtained, the house of cards that the defendant relies on must fold. Without wanting to belabor the points that flow from that, naturally, I would happily address any questions that the court may have, but I don't wish to take up unnecessary time.
Talk to us a little bit about the terms of the written agreement that was signed by the actual renter of the apartment and the possible application of the carrier.
With the court's indulgence, I unfortunately am not as familiar with the record as Ms. Martin probably was, but with indulgence, perhaps I can find a citation to the actual agreement.
It's, if you go to the appendix 657-58. And the agreement essentially says that the guest must comply with all the laws, and failing to do so may result in the renter being asked to leave the premises.
Well, and I think I would not put undue attention in the analysis of this issue as to whether the law was being violated. My understanding was the agreement permitted for the routine inspection, even short of suspecting a violation of the law, simply to go in and check on the cleanliness of the state of the room.
But that doesn't get law enforcement into the room. It gets the...
Certainly, but I think absolutely, and respectfully, Your Honor, I would submit once Fowler is lawfully in the room and sees marijuana in plain view, that is the game. So, I don't...
Except that the law says that observation of a violation of the law alone does not permit law enforcement entry into the room.
Well, Your Honor, I would rely on... I would submit that once the police have probable cause, once the police see the marijuana in plain view, they have probable cause to get a warrant.
But you got to get him in the room.
When they can rely on Fowler to get in the room. I think the jurisprudence from McLaughlin and Caldwell is clear that if she has the apparent authority to get in the room, they can rely on that. If she's letting them in, she has the apparent authority, then that gets them in the room. And so this is not a circumstance that's driven by the perception of an immediate violation of law. She has the right to go in the room. They have the right to rely on her right to go in the room. And it doesn't matter whether she's in the room because she suspects a violation of law. The agreement says, look, to make sure this room is in a good state of repair, to make sure that nobody's health is implicated. And you can imagine a circumstance where, say, if the room had an old-fashioned heater and was at risk of putting out carbon monoxide, I mean, a hotel would have a legitimate interest in checking its rooms to make sure there weren't leaks that were putting either that guest or other guests in danger. And that's not connected to an immediate violation of the law, but it's consistent with the property manager's duty to protect the people that are staying there. And so I understand Your Honor's question, but I don't think it's imperative for the resolution of this issue that it's linked to a crime. I mean, clearly we have a property manager who has a right to go in and explore, and the police have the right to rely on that apparent authority. And I think that resolves Your Honor's question, but I'm happy to address it further if Your Honor would like.
Okay. And since you still have 8 minutes left, if you'd indulge me a little bit, how about the trial court's findings relating to exigency and whether or not the exclusionary rule would apply in this instance?
Certainly. Well, as noted on the brief, I think the specific argument raised on appeal was not presented to the trial court, specifically that the officers manufactured their own exigency. So I would submit that argument is waived for appellate review. But nevertheless, I think clearly the officer was entitled to be where he was in the hallway. I think the facts did not demonstrate, at least the facts viewed in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, did not demonstrate that Brooks forced entry into the room. And while he was there, he witnessed the defendant attempting to destroy evidence. And clearly that's the archetypal manner of exigency that exists for the exception. And with respect to inevitable discovery, I would submit that, consistent with Jones, the factors necessary to provide that exception to the exclusionary rule exist in this record. So even if the court were to conclude that there were a Fourth Amendment violation, there are ways to get around that for this specific case. This would not.
Would that be true for all the evidence, including the photos taken by the officers and that kind of thing that occurred at arguably a time when they might not have had the right to be there? I know this wasn't your case, Mr. Katz, and we appreciate you jumping in to try and...
Yes, Your Honor. I want to make sure I give the court a fulsome answer because it is an important question. I think the answer to that question has to be yes. I mean, if we're assuming circumstances in which it would have been discovered by lawful means but for police misconduct, perhaps not the photographs, but certainly testimony about it. And I don't know that, and perhaps that's one step removed from what the actual record is. So
this is a law school exam case.
Certainly
there is no doubt about that. So
I think even if the court were to say that the photographs of the drugs taken in situ when the police came were subject to suppression, inevitable discovery would not have prevented testimony about what was seen. And so perhaps that, because there was testimony, I know there was testimony about the photographs, but I think there was also testimony about what the officers saw. So I think the closest answer I could give, Your Honor, is that even if the court were to conclude the photographs somehow were subject to the exclusionary rule, clearly the officers who were there and would have been there but for the illegality could testify to what they saw. I think that's
okay.
The best answer I can give, Your Honor.
Thank you. Jay Allen, any questions?
Jay Allen. Thank you.
Thank you. Not sure if any of the appellee's arguments prompt you to have any further statements, but
just a few brief statements that I'm sure will take up the majority of my time. When we look at the agreement really isn't anything different than what people normally expect at a hotel. They expect that people can go in to clean their room.
Isn't this a little more expansive? I mean, how many times do people check into a hotel that indicates that the manager is free to inspect and come in?
Well, I think that's still governed by reasonableness, and one of the things I cited in my brief was from hotel law, and that essentially states that this contract in any way would be reasonable, would be cabined by some grounds of reasonableness. We would expect that if it's 2:00 in the morning and you're asleep in your hotel room, that the management, because you signed that contract, doesn't mean management can barge in and start deciding to look into cabinets and checking the drain for a clock, unless it's an immediate issue that you probably would have woken up to anyways. Similarly, if you were, as I mentioned in my brief, if you're getting out of the shower at that point and the management's trying to come in, I think at that point that would be unreasonable, and you could say that they, even if they're sitting there waving the contract, you could say, please leave, because you have an expectation of privacy in the room. Although that contract changes things, that contract was not known by the police prior to entry. The contract was only later presented at the motion to suppress, and Detective Clark, who is one of the officers that made entry, even testified. He only found out about that contract later.
The Commonwealth says that doesn't matter, and they say case law. Do you have any case law to the contrary?
In terms of the agreement or
in terms of whether they know or not? I mean,
whether they know,
assumption of the apparent authority of the motel owner.
Well, it goes to what, in terms of doing the apparent authority analysis, you look at of what an objective officer could, what they know. You look at objective facts. What did they know?
So if a motel manager calls you and tells you they see drugs in a room and they they want you to come into the room with them, then you don't have, it's not reasonable for the officer to believe that the manager of the motel has the ability to take them into the room?
Well, Matlock specifically says we can't rely on that. And I'd also point, and I know these are only persuasive cases to the, as they are unreported and from the district courts for the Fourth Circuit, but Pope and Story, I think, show how the law should, they cite all the same cases that I've cited on brief, they in support of it. And you have two factual scenarios that are quite different. And in Pope, you have the officers being let in by hotel staff, going and searching the room, and the court found that that was a violation of the Fourth Amendment. In Story, in contrast, what you have is hotel management going in. At that point, they're a private actor. There's no Fourth Amendment involved. Going in, seeing a contraband, removing the contraband, putting it in the manager's office, summoning the police. The police are then in a place where they have a legal right to be, which is the manager's office, when they view those items, and then they do what we would suggest should have happened in this case, is get a warrant before they went into the room.
Does it matter that your client admitted during his testimony that he was using cocaine, marijuana, and heroin in the room that day?
I don't believe that matters. I don't think that changes the issue. I think that gets to a harmless, whether the violations were essentially harmless error given his testimony. The analysis for, it's constitutional harmless error. And what you have in this case is you have senior officers, junior officers making multiple entries into a room. If that's not flagrant disregard for the Fourth Amendment and the protections of one's privacy under that, then I don't know what is.